This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 9th, 2007, from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, the Senate confirms Michael Mukasey as the next Attorney General, activists prepare for the final FCC media ownership hearing, and hundreds of thousands of workers go on strike in Italy. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Leilani Albano with some of the headlines. Pakistani police have blocked Benazir Bhutto from attending a rally against emergency rule in the country. According to Al Jazeera, police surrounded the home of the former prime minister and leader of the Pakistan People's Party, who is presently under house arrest. The move against the former PPP leader came amid a larger crackdown on her supporters, with as many as 5,000 arrested since Wednesday to head off a planned rally. While Bhutto's stance is in seeming opposition to the government, she must walk a fine line in her dealings with President Pervez Musharraf, who has stated his intentions to share power with the former leader. The drug maker Merck agreed to pay one of the largest settlements in U.S. history today to end lawsuits filed by people harmed by the painkiller Vioxx. Zach Batter reports from Vancouver on the $4.8 billion payout.
The drug company reached its nearly $5 billion agreement today with lawyers of more than 47,000 plaintiffs. This could close more than 25,000 lawsuits across the U.S. Merck's own research proved the popular painkiller doubled the user's chance of heart attack. The FDA estimates Vioxx killed nearly 30,000 people between 1993 and 2003. Nearly 100 million Americans were prescribed the drug during that period. Analysts say the potential liability of Vioxx could amount to as much as $25 billion because of the thousands of cases of Vioxx users who had a heart attack or stroke. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Vancouver.
The House will vote on the overhaul alternative minimum tax today. This tax was established in 1969 to prevent millionaires from avoiding federal income taxes. FSRN's Zain El Amin reports.
Democrats managed to pass the alternative minimum tax, which was created to be a tax for the wealthy but is expected to affect 23 million people this year, up from 3.4 million last year. Due to inflation, people with annual incomes as low as $50,000 are taxed. The Democratic legislation would exclude anyone making less than $200,000, which would include 97% of all taxpayers. To offset the loss of government revenue, taxes on the private equity and hedge fund managers who are in the top 3% of American earners would increase, bringing their tax rates up to 35%. Lee Ferris, federal tax policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy.
Taxing the income for private equity and hedge fund managers the same as regular income is an excellent idea. These are some of the wealthiest people in the country, and it's only fair for them to pay the same rate as firefighters and school teachers.
Republicans voted unanimously against the measure because they oppose a tax increase for the wealthy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zain El Amin.
The state of California took the Bush administration to court over global warming. California charges that the administration's Environmental Protection Agency is inhibiting California's efforts to impose stricter regulations to combat global warming causing pollutants. The Clean Air Act allows states to take initiative in their regulation, but only if the EPA gives permission. The EPA said it is working as fast as they can and are backlogged with applications, which is why they haven't granted California clearance. A U.S. District Court judge today granted a preliminary injunction that bars the Army from proceeding with a second court-martial trial of First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. Sarah Olson has more.
The U.S. Army cannot retry First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, according to a district court ruling yesterday. Federal Judge Benjamin Settle issued a preliminary injunction Thursday afternoon confirming Lieutenant Watada's assertions that the Army's attempts to proceed with a second court-martial were a violation of the lieutenant's Fifth Amendment protections against being tried for the same crime twice. Lieutenant Aaron Watada became the first officer to publicly refuse to deploy to Iraq in June 2006. Lieutenant Watada claimed the Iraq War is immoral and a violation of domestic and international law. Activists held a press conference this morning in San Francisco.
In today's climate, where torture is justified and habeas corpus is being thrown out the window, each military appeals court simply passed it on to the next, denying Lieutenant Watada a fair hearing. And it was outrageous that the military courts could not uphold the United States Constitution.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Olson in San Francisco.
This is Leilani Albano with some of the headlines.
The Federal Communications Commission will hold its sixth and final public hearing this evening on proposed changes to media ownership rules. FCC Chair Kevin Martin has been on a fast track to pass changes by December. Those changes would relax regulations that determine the number of media outlets a single entity could own. But he's been met with widespread opposition from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and media watchdog groups nationwide who say that the process for soliciting public comment has been flawed. Yesterday, Senator Byron Dorgan said he would introduce legislation to impose a 3-month delay on the commission's decision. Representative Hilda Solis is a member of the Telecommunications Committee on Energy and Commerce.
What we want to see is that there's more opportunity for minority and women owned business. Even after this administration changes, this is still going to be a big issue for many of us from our minority and underrepresented communities, because we have to strive for that. Our community is growing. We have a fast-growing market in the Hispanic community, and we know that it has to be valued and respected.
This morning, I spoke with Yvonne Roman, the executive director of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists.
Well, what we've seen in the studies is that the more concentrated the media market is, the fewer minority owners there are. And what happens is there are fewer opportunities for independent stations and independent radio to actually get a foothold in the market. As a large, as we saw with Clear Channel, for example, and Univision Radio, which bought up large radio chains, and fewer people were able to actually gain a foothold in the market. And that affects news, which is what we're interested in, because what happened in those cases is that they virtually eliminated all news personnel and newscasts and pipe in like a standard program.
There have been a lot of complaints lately coming out about the FCC's handling of public process. There's a hearing tonight in Seattle. They only announced where and when the hearing would be 7 days previous. What's your assessment of this?
The process that they're following is specifically designed to keep the public out of the process in the first place. And we have seen this over and over again. We saw this with hearings. The first hearing they had in Los Angeles, they did the same exact thing. They called us up, as a matter of fact. The FCC called us up a week before the hearing was supposed to take place in Los Angeles and couldn't tell us exactly where the hearing was going to be, at what time it was going to be. And this is a week before. So we couldn't really participate at that time because of that. And these delays and this process of calling up a hearing at the last minute, basically, is that it's clear to us that that's what it's designed for, to try to get as few people as possible to this hearing, and as a way to ameliorate or I guess dampen the opposition to the relaxation of these rules.
That was Yvonne Roman, the executive director of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Last night, the U.S. Senate confirmed Judge Michael Mukasey as the next attorney general. The 53-40 vote in his favor was much closer than originally expected when he was nominated. Mukasey was initially praised by both sides as a non-political appointee, but his confirmation became uncertain after his second day of congressional testimony. During that testimony, he told a Senate panel that he thought the interrogation practice of waterboarding or simulated drowning was a repugnant practice, but not torture. This outraged human rights advocates and many Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
We have executed people for waterboarding Americans. So it's for the nominee for Attorney General to be so evasive in the answer as to whether waterboarding is torture is someone who does not understand history.
Despite these concerns, six Democrats joined Republican ranks in supporting Mukasey. One of those Democrats was New York Senator Charles Schumer, who said there were more important things to consider than Mukasey's stance on waterboarding.
Well, look, I think there are different views. I have tremendous respect for my colleagues in how they feel. And this is one issue where I feel differently than many of them. I feel that torture should be made illegal. I feel waterboarding should be made illegal. But I also feel that the Justice Department is a shambles. I've spent a large amount of time, about 8 months, trying to get a new Attorney General. And I think on those areas, the depoliticization, getting the Civil Rights Division back, that Mukasey will do a good job. And that's why I have supported him.
The Justice Department has been without senior leadership since September, when Alberto Gonzalez resigned. Hearing the result of the Mukasey vote, House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers did not waste any time. This morning, he sent a letter to Mukasey restating a former request for 3 secret Justice Department legal opinions. The opinions allegedly authorized the use of torture on terrorism suspects. Conyers is looking for confirmation that the opinions were indeed made, and if so, that the details be released to Congress. In a 285-132 vote Thursday, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Peru Free Trade Agreement. The new law would eliminate trade tariffs and establish investment rules between the U.S. and the South American nation. It is expected to increase trade receipts by more than 15%. Republicans overwhelmingly supported the bill, but for Democrats, the question came down to protecting workers in other countries or protecting jobs here in the U.S. Karen Miller reports.
The split began to grow among Democrats when some felt there was not enough job protections for U.S. workers against offshoring. Representative Mike Michaud, Democrat from Maine.
They worry whether or not they'll have a paycheck in the years to come. We have all seen the ugly face of trade agreements that don't live up to the promises. When will we truly change the course of trade policy? If you stand by President Bush, whose track record of listening to corporations instead of the men and women of this country, by all means, vote for this trade deal. But if you stand by the working men and women of this country, I would encourage you must vote no.
In fact, even though the bill passed, most Democrats did vote no. David Adeli from the group Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
Some leaders in the Democratic Party had discussed this trade agreement as a model for a new set of free trade agreements that the Bush administration has asked the Democrats to pass. This result of having a majority of Democrats vote against it really shows that we're still a long way from having a framework for trade agreements that can earn broad public support nationwide.
Critics charge that the U.S. should learn the lessons from past trade agreements. In 1994, the U.S. and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. That agreement was supposed to improve the lives of people in Mexico, but Hector Sanchez, policy director of the International Human Rights and Social Justice Organization Global Exchange, says in many ways the opposite happened. He says the Peru agreement goes down the same path.
The kind of agreements that they are putting in place is the kind of agreements that provide all the benefits just for a small group of people, particularly corporations, that have only one goal, profit. Why don't we globalize environmental regulations? Why don't we globalize labor rights? Why don't we globalize minimum wages? Why don't we globalize basic standards for workers?
For those Republicans who voted with Democrats to ultimately pass the bill, however, it was more of an issue of economics, with the possibility of job losses not outweighing the benefits. Representative John Boehner, Republican from Ohio.
I understand that there's displacement in our economy, and we ought to be doing everything we can to retrain and train workers for the new economy. But that's going to happen regardless of whether we pass this.
Free trade agreements for Panama, Colombia, and South Korea are still pending, but Congress is not expected to vote on them this year. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The 17th Ibero-American Summit began today in Chile's capital, Santiago. There, Chile's president, Michelle Bachelet, called upon other South American leaders to implement an agenda of social inclusion. The region's leaders not only agreed with Bachelet, but also motioned for increased regional unity in resisting U.S. involvement in Latin America. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón explains.
passionate call for the democratization, inclusion, and modernization of social programs that respect and protect the rights of citizens. The leaders here were in agreement. Many spoke of moving the region away from free market policies and the institutions part of the so-called Washington Consensus. Argentina's President Néstor Kirchner says the region has to lose its fears so that the Ibero-American nations can have a strong voice on issues such as the occupation of Iraq. Kirchner also says it's time to build inclusive social policies and implement economic model that do not follow destructive policies dictated from international organizations like the IMF.
This Ibero-American summit has to consolidate this belief because of the IMF policies, and I hope the IMF changes its attitudes. I have said this repeatedly anywhere I've been, because they are the ones who guided us and told us who were the good students and how to do things for our people's benefits. I believe this summit has to advance, that from this body, those of us who represent our peoples can build a diverse and pluralistic system.
Venezuela's Hugo Chavez agreed with Kirchner and invited all the leaders to this December join in launching of the new Reconstruction Bank of the South that can replace the IMF as an effort to build the region's political, economic, and social cohesion.
Soon the Bank of the South will see light and will begin with modest capital, but we are advancing towards a great development bank. And later, we must create an economic protection fund that gives fiscal support to the economies that need it.
The summit continues until Saturday. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón at the 17th Ibero-American Summit in Santiago.
Workers in Italy are holding a general strike today in protest of a new labor agreement reached between the country's three largest unions and the government of Romano Prodi. Among other things, the agreement allows for the retirement age of Italian workers to be raised 3 years by 2011. It's estimated that millions of Italians did not work today, and as many as 400,000 demonstrated in cities across the country. Deleda Varlesi has more from Brescia.
The general strike was called by the independent trade unions Covas Confederation and RDB Workers Union to protest against the 2008 financial plan, project of law by Prodi's center-left government. Across the country, about 2 million people did not go to work and 400,000 took the streets in many cities. The largest demonstrations took place in Milan and Rome with 50,000 participants each. Piero Bernocchi is National Secretary of the Covas Confederation.
Here in Rome, the strike shut down the majority of transport services and half of school activities. I believe that there were many, many more demonstrators than last year, and I'm glad to see that a lot of university students, activists, and workers in precarious situations attended the rally. It's a very mixed people presence here this morning. There are also many public employees.
Workers, specifically from the public sectors, airport, train, bus, subway, and ferry boat employees, as well as public service workers from post offices, hospitals, and municipalities, showed up in full force. Maria Minni is a secondary school teacher.
We're protesting because we want to have conditions to do our job properly. We want to do our jobs well. The financial plan for the coming year did not add a single euro into education projects.
Simone Belli is a temporary worker, a center-left voter, disappointed by Prodi's administration.
Those whistles are for Prodi. Shame on him, because he did not maintain what he promised.
Problems arose when Prodi's government announced last 23rd of July that retirement age would be increased from 58 to 65 years of age. Nevertheless, is a problem of great concern for younger workers between 20 and 40 years of age who are often hired under a contract that expires after 3 or 6 months, with no automatic renewal and very low salaries. Gisella Flores is a nurse. She works in a hospital with no regular contract. She's a temporary worker, a so-called project worker, which means she will be immediately fired when the contract expires.
We're like ghosts. No one can see us. We keep working in a public hospital, but we're not public employees. We're contracted by private cooperatives.
Micaela Giusti works as a telemarketer. She works for a company that is in charge to call people at home and try to sell any sort of things of different market areas. And she explains the impossibility to get a proper salary in this work.
In call center market work, full-time contract work does not exist. All contracts are only for part-time work, which automatically excludes the possibility of earning respectable salary and social security.
Some government workers join in today's demonstrations to protest a mass firing of parliament employees. Enrico Montalbano is a former parliament secretary.
Prodi respected his promises. He said, I'll find a solution for workers in precarious situations. And he did. He fired all of us.
Other demonstrations will take place in coming months, since the financial plan is actually under evaluation at the parliament, a regular process before it becomes law. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese in Brescia, Italy.
Despite opposition from human rights and civil liberties groups, the German government today adopted a controversial information holding law. The European Union's Data Retention Directive requires telecommunications companies to hold all data for up to 2 years. Officials pushed the directive through by touting its value in fighting organized crime and terrorism. Cinnamon Nepard has more from Berlin.
Norbert Geis, Member of Parliament from the conservative right political party, the Christian Social Union of Bavaria, or CSU, believes the EU Data Retention Directive is a necessary step in law enforcement.
I'm convinced that we need these measures to fight organized crime and terrorism. From my point of view, there is no alternative.
Coordinator of the nationwide protests in Germany and member of the Working Group Against Data Retention, Ricardo Christoph Remmert-Fontes, disagrees.
We believe the directive will not raise the success of law enforcement in the area of terrorism and organized crime. But, of course, what you can think about is file sharing, for example, and other... not so heavy crimes can be the target of this directive.
Under the German implementation of this directive, lawyers, the clergy and parliamentarians will be exempt from surveillance. But that leaves journalists and their sources wide open. Markus Beckerdahl is a political blogger from netzpolitik.org.
I think data retention is a big problem for every citizen. It's a big problem for journalists because all their contacts will not contact them anymore about over communication or telecommunication, because they will fear that the government finds out who gives information to the journalists.
Erik Josefsson, Brussels spokesperson from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, says the potential for abuse in such a system of surveillance is very high, especially if a government is corrupt or becomes a dictatorship, targeting certain groups in society. But it's also a concern for anyone who uses technology for any sort of communication.
There are always errors in all systems, and this could be like a kind of a lottery where you win the label organized criminal or terrorist because of a mistake.
Given Germany's history of surveillance and dictatorships, implementing the new directive seems like a bit of a contradiction. But Member of Parliament for the CSU, Norbert Geis, says it's inevitable.
Wir haben natürlich schlechte Erfahrungen in Ostdeutschland mit dem Stasi gemacht und während der Nazizeit mit der Gestapo. Wir wissen,
we have had bad experiences with the East German Stasi and the Gestapo during the Nazi regime, so we know what it's like to be under surveillance. On the other hand, we understand the necessity of different types of surveillance, because when there is a threat of crime, and when crime needs to be prevented or fought, it needs to be done through criminal prosecution. You can never forget that security is necessary for freedom. Security is the foundation of freedom. If the average citizen is threatened by terrorist attacks, then his basic freedom is threatened. That's why it's so vital to ensure freedom through security.
Remmert-Fontes from the Data Retention Working Group says they won't give up the fight against the EU directive.
The next great step is to file a complaint at the Constitutional Court. And this complaint is actually now the biggest complaint or constitutional complaint which has ever been filed to the Constitutional Court, because it is signed by over 7,000 citizens.
The Irish government has filed a case against the EU Data Retention Directive at the European Court of Justice, or ECJ, contesting the way in which this European legislation was passed, not on the actual contents of the directive. The ECJ is due to decide on that case early next year. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
In this week's political roundup, a few presidential candidates who haven't been catching the media's eye have made some history-making moves, and some progressive groups are staking their claims in next year's elections. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
FSRN tries to focus on the issues, not the money game. But this record-breaking act was just too astonishing to ignore.
I'm Ron Paul, and I'm the only presidential candidate.
Representative Ron Paul, libertarian running on the Republican ticket, who receives little press coverage, broke a fundraising record. On November 5th, he raised a phenomenal $4 million, the largest primary one-day total and largest one-day internet sum ever. Here's his fundraising director, Jonathan Goodlatte.
We had 38,869 donations coming yesterday from 36,672 individuals, and that includes 17,396 new donors.
Another undercover candidate, Representative Dennis Kucinich, followed through with his campaign pitch that Vice President Dick Cheney should be impeached.
There are millions of Americans who are part of a national movement to defend the Constitution, and they understand that the vice president made a false claim for war and is trying to beat the drums for a war against Iran, and they're calling for action to be done.
The vice president isn't yet impeached, but some of the progressive bloc is energized. Progressive Democrats of America are engaging voters by advertising their 7 election priorities. And Democratic candidate John Edwards received the endorsement of former Ben & Jerry's co-owner Ben Cohen and 10,000 Iowa voters. Cohen says that Edwards is committed to shifting the most national spending from defense to domestic interests. And protesters in Iowa are targeting the campaigns of Senator Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani. They're demanding they make Iraq a central part of the campaign and vow to bring all troops home. But at this week's protest, the cops were called and 19 protesters were arrested, according to AfterDowningStreet.org. The Republican Party is threatening to punish 5 states because they moved their primaries to January. With or without these possible repercussions, only 2 months are left until the first votes are cast, and candidates are spending more time in the main primary states of Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. They're also trying to rack up the endorsements that are usually more important for the press and the big donors than they really are for the voters.
To me, the overriding issue before the American people is the defense of our population from the bloodlust of Islamic terrorists. Our second goal should be the control of massive government waste and crushing federal deficits.
That was evangelical Pat Robertson, hoping to give Rudy Giuliani conservative credentials. Republican Senator John McCain received an important conservative endorsement, that of Senator Sam Brownback, who dropped out of the presidential race last month. And Hillary Clinton received an endorsement that she hopes can prove that she is not a polarizing figure. Ohio Governor Ted Strickland has high approval ratings among Democrats, independents, and Republicans.
I consider her experienced, a strong leader. These are very serious times for our nation and the world, and I believe that we need a serious leader who is capable of bringing about the change that I think we so desperately need.
All candidates are planning to spend their Veterans Day on the campaign trail, appealing to veterans. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.